look at a percent of the total surgeries, this number isn't alarming. But if it's my mom, that number's alarming, even one.
Four hospitals in Alaska face Medicare fines for patient safety concerns. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, arguing in federal court for better voter translations into native languages.
It's not an impossible task. You hear that it's more complicated than the defendants would like it to be, but it's not impossible. They're choosing not to do it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
A powerful underwater earthquake in the western Aleutians triggered tsunami alerts for parts of the Aleutian Islands this afternoon. KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports.
No damages were reported after the magnitude 8.0 quake recorded just before 1 p.m. today. It happened about 30 miles northwest of Amchitka, about 60 miles underwater. Residents in the western Aleutians reported feeling shaking during the quake, according to the Alaska Earthquake Information Center, and the quake has set off a series of aftershocks, some as strong as a magnitude 6. The earthquake also generated a tsunami warning from Attu to Nikolski and in the Pribilof Islands for about 2 hours today. It was then downgraded to an advisory. The Unalaska area from Nikolski to Unimak Pass was also under an advisory for part of this afternoon. That ended around 4 p.m. The tsunami alert stemmed from the force of the quake, but the Earthquake Center's Natasha Rupert says tremors at such a depth don't often create tsunamis.
Well, based on its magnitude, there is definitely potential for a tsunami in Aleutian Islands. But based on its depth, I do not expect that there will be significant tsunami from this earthquake.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration observed tsunami waves about a foot in height or less in Unalaska, Adak, and other islands in the region. Those waves are measured at the highest water level above the tide level. They weren't high enough to do any damage. Unalaska's Department of Public Safety told residents to avoid beaches and harbors during the advisory, but there was no full-scale evacuation to high ground. Today's quake was near an active volcanic island in the western Aleutians. Semisopochnoi has been undergoing a series of small quakes, most around magnitude 2, for the past couple of weeks. But the Earthquake Center's Rupert says the activity isn't connected.
All earthquakes that are related to volcanoes, they are very shallow, right beneath the surface. And this one is about 100 kilometers deep.
It was a busy day for earthquakes in the Pacific, though. Another one with a magnitude 7.2 was recorded in the South Pacific off New Zealand about an hour and a half before the quake in the Aleutians. Rupert says it's possible that one triggered the other, but they don't know for sure. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
The four largest hospitals in Alaska are facing Medicare payment penalties for the quality of their care. Providence, Alaska Regional, Alaska Native Medical Center, and Fairbanks Memorial are all in the bottom 25% nationally for the number of infections and serious complications patients get in their hospitals, according to data analyzed by Kaiser Health News. The penalties are part of a focus on quality care that's included in the Affordable Care Act. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
Central lines are IVs inserted in veins that lead right to a patient's heart. Infections in those lines are serious. And in 2012, Providence, Alaska Medical Center in Anchorage had 17 of them in their intensive care units.
There was no one thing, single thing. There was no smoking gun. We were not doing X.
Dr. Dick Monsager is Providence's hospital administrator. He says the hospital recognized the infections as they were happening and started paying attention to every detail for patients with central lines. In 2013, Providence had 6 central line infections instead of 17.
Making sure that the whole bundle of care is done every single time all the time, regardless of how pressured you are, regardless of how many things you got on your mind.
The spike in central line infections in 2012 helped push Providence into the lowest quarter of hospitals nationally for safety measures Medicare is tracking. The analysis is preliminary, but the fines are unlikely to change when the final numbers are out later this year. In Alaska, Providence has plenty of company. The state's three other big hospitals, Alaska Native Medical Center, Fairbanks Memorial, and Alaska Regional, are all receiving penalties for patient safety. As a result, the hospitals will lose 1% of their Medicare payments for a year starting in October. Julie Taylor is the new CEO of Alaska Regional. She says her hospital's poor score is due in part to an increase in post-surgical blood clots, 7 total during the year the Medicare data was pulled from.
If you look at a percent of the total surgeries, this number isn't alarming. But if it's my mom, that number's alarming, even one.
Taylor says Alaska Regional has emphasized training to bring down the rate of blood clots and other complications, which is especially important given a staff turnover rate of 20% annually at the hospital.
What that means to you is that we've got to retrain staff that are coming in, make sure that they understand all the protocols, because this takes hardwiring. You know, it's not by happenstance that these things are prevented. It absolutely has to be hardwired, and that's why orientation and training and vigilance has to take place.
Taylor applauds Medicare's effort to track patient safety and penalize the worst performing hospitals. That's a point all of the hospitals agreed on, including Fairbanks Memorial. Jenna Edmiston is chief nursing officer there. She says during the last year, the hospital has had a new focus on patient safety.
We meet every 2 weeks, look at every single safety incident in the hospital. We address them and then very consciously look for results.
Edmiston says Fairbanks Memorial has seen steep drops in some areas, like central line infections. Other problems, like patient falls, have been harder to address. All the hospitals pointed out potential problems with the way Medicare measures quality. Alaska Native Medical Center's Jay Butler chairs the Infection Control Committee there and says his hospital's poor score flagged one main problem.
The one that really stands out to us is the catheter-associated urinary tract infection rate.
Butler says many of the cases were from a type of bug that colonizes the urinary tract without causing an infection, basically something that looks and acts like an infection but isn't one. He says the hospital will address how those cases are handled. He says the way Medicare issues hospital penalties isn't perfect, but it's better than nothing.
We've got to track how we're doing. Otherwise, we have no idea whether or not we're making progress. We wouldn't even know whether or not we're providing good care.
But a Harvard health policy expert has big problems with the way Medicare is measuring quality. Professor Ashish Jha says large teaching hospitals and urban hospitals tend to get the bulk of the penalties. He thinks that may be because they're doing a better job documenting complications compared to hospitals that aren't even aware of errors.
What you end up doing is you essentially end up penalizing hospitals that are more vigilant, that are paying closer attention, are documenting the complications, and coding them in their billing data.
Still, Jha thinks infection rates, which do not come from billing data, are important quality measures. He says hospitals should have close to zero central line infections, the problem Providence struggled with, if they're following standard practice. Dr. Monsager from Providence says the hospital's goal is zero central line infections, but it's a challenge.
I could not have predicted 20 years ago In the measures that get publicly reported, how close you have to be to perfection. Otherwise, you're doing poorly comparatively. Do I feel bad about our current performance? Absolutely.
Monsager is confident Providence will not be in the same position during the next round of Medicare penalties. In the meantime, he says the 1% cut in Medicare payments is significant. The Alaska hospital systems stand to lose between $200,000 and $700,000 each to the penalties. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
An initiative that would add another roadblock to the Pebble Mine project will appear on the ballot this fall, now that a legal challenge against it has failed. The Alaska Supreme Court issued an expedited order today saying the initiative was constitutional. The order comes less than 2 weeks after the justices heard the case. The lawsuit was brought by a coalition of mining groups who believe the initiative is invalid because it only regulates mining in one part of the state. But initiative sponsors and the Alaska Division of Elections defended the ballot proposition, which would require the legislature to approve large-scale mining operations in the Bristol Bay region. They argued the health of that watershed and its salmon fishery is an issue of statewide importance. A federal trial has kicked off to determine whether the state of Alaska does enough to serve voters who speak native languages. Natalie Landreth is arguing the case for the Native American Rights Fund. She says there's a huge amount of voting information available to people who speak English, Spanish, and Tagalog, compared to the amount of materials for speakers of Yupik and Gwich'in. She says the disparity amounts to discrimination.
It's not an impossible task. You hear that it's more complicated than the defendants would like it to be, but it's not impossible. It's very practical. They're choosing not to do it.
Libby Bacalar is an assistant attorney general defending the state's position. She says the Division of Elections does want Native voters to be enfranchised, but there are unique obstacles to serving some populations in the state. She notes there are only 300 speakers of Gwich'in who are capable of doing translating work for the state, and until recently, the state had to clear many of its policies with the Federal Department of Justice.
These aren't some sort of excuses for not doing a good job. The division does everything it can with the resources that it has.
The trial will last for 8 days, with each side having 4 days to present witnesses. The first witnesses were called by the plaintiffs, and they pointed out situations where voting materials had low readability scores. They also brought up examples of ballot measures being mistranslated, noting that in the case of the 2012 initiative that described managing coastal areas as playing by the beach. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a group of ski mountaineers celebrate a first for the Alaska Range.
I don't plan on topping this, ever. That feeling, that sense of accomplishment, being on top of all the mountains was incredible.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Governor Sean Parnell on Friday signed a bill to finance a $900 million bridge across Knik Arm from Anchorage to Point McKenzie. Bridge proponents originally wanted to fund the project entirely with federal earmarks, but then Congress banned earmarks, in part due to public outrage over this bridge and another in Ketchikan, both derided nationally as bridges to nowhere. The new Knik Bridge plan is contingent on low-interest loans from the federal government. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports on the loan program the state is pinning its hopes on.
Knik Arm Bridge fans would have envied Los Angeles last month. In a U.S. Senate hearing room, California representatives were high-fiving themselves for winning more than $2 billion to extend a subway line to the city's west side. Senator Barbara Boxer was delighted.
Listen to these numbers. They're even big by Washington standards. In addition to the $1.25 billion full funding grant agreement, for which we are so grateful to this administration, the Purple Line Extension Project is also benefiting from an $856 million loan made possible through the TIFIA program.
That's the program Alaska hopes will lend the state more than $340 million for the Knik Bridge. Boxer is one of its chief proponents in Congress.
TIFIA, Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act.
As she explains it, the program is designed to lend the money needed to get a project started while other revenues roll in more slowly.
Because when you put together projects like this, they're enormous, and they're enormously important. So you've got to use all the options at your disposal.
Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti thanked his senators and the federal government, but says the real reason they got the money is that Angelenos reached into their own wallets first. Garcetti commends local voters for approving a 30-year sales tax to pay for transportation.
And we're not coming here hat in hand with an empty hat. We come here to get it topped off, and we know that. We know that in this changed landscape, we have to bring something to the game in order to get more, and we consistently do.
Alaska isn't coming entirely hat in hand to the feds either. In the past, they'd asked TIFIA to finance nearly half the bridge costs. But federal officials said they wanted to see more of a state commitment. So now the state is asking TIFIA to cover about a third. Another third would come from other federal transportation dollars. And for the state's third, it plans to issue up to $300 million in bonds, but only if it gets the TIFIA money first. The plan is to pay it all off with tolls, estimated at $5 per car. Alaska Transportation Development Director Jeff Otteson told state senators in April the financing plan is smart for the state.
We're getting a chance to build this, and quite frankly, somebody else is going to pay a large piece of the tab.
Ultimately, the U.S. Transportation Secretary decides which projects TIFIA will fund. The department made no one available to interview for this story. But Steve Ellis, Vice President of Taxpayers for Common Sense, says the very reason Alaska might like the plan, limited financial commitment, makes it unattractive to federal policymakers. Ellis says Alaska isn't really bringing more revenues to the deal, it's bringing more debt.
People may argue that these bonds are skin in the game, but in reality, it's still somebody else's skin.
His group claims credit for pinning the Bridge to Nowhere label on the Ketchikan Bridge and helped spread the taint to the Kinnick project as well. Last year, Taxpayers for Common Sense gave the Kinnick project a second Golden Fleece Award intended to highlight wasteful federal spending. Ellis predicts the U.S. Transportation Department won't like the loose repayment terms Alaska is proposing.
Certainly, if you're saying that, you know, whatever scraps are left will go to pay off the TIFIA loan, you know, that's going to raise up the hackles of the feds.
Kinnick Bridge proponents shouldn't count on Senator Lisa Murkowski intervening with the department. She says she has concerns about the cost, the routing, and the fairness to other parts of the state. As far as winning TIFIA funds, she thinks it's an uphill battle. Murkowski says it's unfair, but nationally, major Alaska bridge project remains synonymous with pork.
That has clearly stuck. And you can open up a newspaper here in Washington, D.C. today, and you will still see reference to the Bridge to Nowhere.
A spokesman for Alaska Congressman Don Young says he'll support the bridge for TIFIA funds. But he notes Young sent hundreds of millions of dollars to the state to build the bridge back in 2005, but the state chose to spend that money elsewhere. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Anchorage's unemployment rate for May is 4.9%, one of the lowest rates in the state. Though that may seem like a good thing, it's a barrier for growth in the state's largest city. Businesses are having trouble finding reliable workers. KSKA's Ann Hillman learned more.
New retail stores are popping up all around Anchorage. Cabela's, Bass Pro, an outlet mall. And with them come hundreds of entry-level jobs, which could be a problem.
Retail right now, we're hearing a lot of complaints about the lack of qualified workforce.
That's Bill Popp, president and CEO of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation.
Which is an interesting situation to be in, because normally retail has some of the least difficulties in terms of finding people who can, you know, be qualified to come in on an entry-level position.
Pop says low unemployment rates make it hard for businesses to fill the estimated 15 to 2,500 jobs that are currently available in the city, and he expects the rate to drop even lower by the end of summer. But he says the problem isn't just the lack of people seeking work. It's a lack of reliable workers to fill low-wage jobs.
It's more about the quality of the workforce, you know, the skill sets in the individual in terms of a understanding of need to show up to work on time, properly groomed and dressed, understanding fully that they need to be able to pass a drug test, which is a very serious issue for pretty much every employer.
Winnetta Ayers with the state's Department of Labor and Workforce Development calls these work maturity skills, and she says they can be taught to both youth and adults.
Just honestly developing an awareness of it is really a start.
Ayers says the state funds programs aimed at students, at-risk youth, and adults to help them develop the basic communication and work skills necessary to hold down a job. She says they also focus on teaching life skills to help them overcome barriers to working.
For example, they may need childcare. They may need transportation, just to figure out how to structure the kind of support network that they need to be able to show up to work on time and regularly.
Ira says some people, especially youth, aren't employed because they don't really understand their options. She says workers can go to one of the state's 21 job centers and receive guidance.
One of the things that they help people identify is, what is the right occupation for me? What are the labor market conditions? What kinds of growth is possible in that occupation? And so that they're really making an informed choice about what kind of occupation they're choosing to go into.
The state is currently spending $21 million on programs aimed at preparing and training the workforce and teaching people higher-end skills as well. AADC's research shows that there's also a lack of skilled workers in fields like IT and healthcare in Anchorage. Anchorage is the 23rd most expensive city in the U.S. for living, and there's a housing shortage, so it's hard to attract people with specialized training. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
Surrounded by dozens of public employees in the atrium of Juneau's State Office Building, Governor Sean Parnell today signed legislation transferring $3 billion from state savings into Alaska's public employee pension systems. KTOO's Casey Kelly reports.
Like many state and local governments across the country, Alaska's pension shortfall is the result of years of neglect and bad financial advice. Even as the estimated amount of future payments to retired public employees has grown, state and municipal officials opted to put minimal amounts into retirement systems. The cash infusion cuts the long-term projected deficit for the Alaska Public Employees Retirement System and Teachers Retirement System to $9 billion. It also reduces the amount of future annual payments into the systems, which Governor Parnell says is the single biggest cost driver of the state's operating budget.
But beyond both of those worthy goals of this legislation, it takes the burden off of our kids and grandkids to pay this debt that is owed. It's a debt that we will make good on, but it takes that obligation off of future generations of Alaskans.
Parnell says credit rating agencies recommended the state address the shortfall or risk losing its AAA bond rating.
They identified our unfunded pension liability as the single biggest risk to our state. And they said, yeah, there are 49 other states who would love to have your financial challenges, but there is one real financial challenge for you and risk, and that is this unfunded pension liability.
The $3 billion will come out of the state's constitutional budget reserve, part of more than $17.5 billion in state savings, which does not include the Alaska Permanent Fund. Two-thirds will go toward the teachers' retirement system. The rest will go into PERS. Parnell's plan overcame early skepticism from members of his own Republican Party to pass the Alaska legislature by a near-unanimous vote. The idea of putting a large lump sum of cash into state pension systems is not new. In 2012, Senator Johnny Ellis, an Anchorage Democrat, proposed creating a $2 billion special fund to address the state's retirement shortfall. Juneau Senator Dennis Egan, a Democrat who caucuses with the Alaska Senate's Republican-led majority, says it took a while for some of his colleagues to come around to the idea.
People finally realized that there is a serious problem, and this is the only way to fix it.
Alaska communities backed the pension infusion plan. Juneau Assemblywoman Karen Crane is president of the Alaska Municipal League, a group that lobbies the state and federal governments on behalf of cities and boroughs.
30-some percent of the debt belongs to municipalities, and so the quicker we get it paid off, it lowers the cost to all of us.
Right now, local governments contribute 22% of their payroll to PERS every year. Some also put 12.5% into the teachers' retirement system. Crane is hopeful the local contribution will stay at that level until the state pays down its pension shortfall. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
This year's mountaineering season has been one for the record books. Earlier this month, a new speed record was set on Denali, and a team of skiers knocked out back-to-back ascents of the three tallest mountains in the Alaska Range. KSKA's Monica Goki has more.
For Evan Pletcher of Aspen, Colorado, summiting the three tallest peaks in the Alaska Range, that's Hunter, Foraker, and Denali, in a single expedition with three best friends was the experience of a lifetime.
You know, I don't plan on topping this, ever. That feeling, that sense of accomplishment, being on top of all the mountains was incredible. And especially Denali being our last one, we all kind of broke down up there.
It took the team of four 31 days to do all three summits nonstop, and the going was tough.
Like on Mount Hunter, for instance, packs were at least 80 pounds because we went without sleds up that mountain with 6 days of food. So it wasn't light ever.
Pletcher said plans for the trip had been in motion for a couple of years. And the team had a friend, an experienced mountaineer from Colorado, who was giving the group weather updates from afar. Pletcher said those reports were extremely accurate and critical to helping the team bag all three summits back to back.
I feel that we had incredible luck and a great group, and everything just kind of worked in our favor. But I can see why it hadn't been done before. It's very taxing mentally, physically, and the chances of you getting those windows when you need them are just so slim.
For another Denali mountaineer, a one-day window in clear weather was all it took for a successful summit. Spanish mountaineer Kilian Borgada went up and down the mountain in just under 12 hours. 11 hours and 40 minutes, to be exact. There's no official record-keeping group for speed ascents, but nobody is raising eyebrows at Borgada's time. He's known for being fast. Very fast. Coley Gensel at the Talkeetna Ranger Station says speed ascents up Denali aren't actually that uncommon. Borgada's time breaks the last record by a couple of hours. Kilian Borgada didn't just hop a plane to Alaska, sling a backpack over his shoulder, and climb as fast as he could. There's a lot of preparation and acclimating involved in speed climbs. Gensel explains.
Yeah, what most folks will do is to acclimate ahead of time, to sort of spend time at the higher elevations and even go to the summit for a week or 2 weeks, even 3 weeks prior to their speed climb so that they're acclimated. Then they come back to base camp and wait for a good weather window to then climb up and down as fast as they can.
Gensel says most of the folks attempting speed ascents on Denali are very experienced mountaineers. But overall, speed climbers and ski mountaineers represent just a sliver of the 1,200-odd climbers who tackle Denali every season. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Goki.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Ann Hillman and Monica Goki in Anchorage, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. If you're having trouble taking medications or forgetting to take pills on time, there's help available for these serious common problems. Talk to your prescriber or pharmacist right away and visit meded.alaska.gov. There you'll find tips on safety, saving money, and more. When you take your medications as directed, you protect your health and independence. You protect your future. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.